Good morning, everyone. Sorry for the little wait at the beginning, but we couldn't find the cloth for my Dharma talk. And that session is such a great training place for just the unexpected. I'm still correcting my spelling on this talk, and you know, it was time to get Roshi, and we can't find the cloth, and everything is just flowing, and you just sit in it, and you're very thankful that you have such kind, open faces to support you through the process. I'm going to continue the work of the previous Dharma talks during actually the entire Angha, in looking at Dogen's talk on the Bodhisattva's four methods. So as Esho reminded us, all four methods are included in Dogen's work, One Bright Pearl. All the universe is one bright pearl. What need is there to understand? We don't even need to describe it, other than this moniker, one bright pearl. And as Kaku noted, the direct naming quality in the words of the four methods is very different from Dogen's approach in his other works, where he gives us this incredible, subtle poetry, layer upon layer of meaning. But since Roshi reminded us, these are not, the four methods aren't from Dogen. He found them, they're part of the Pali canon. And he probably found this passage and decided it had merit. And he would present it, he would put his panache on it, but he would basically present four very simple approaches of guidance for people who want to be in community with one another. When I was back in the city, I was really enamored. Some people, I get the sense that some people feel this is a, you know, it's almost so basic kind of text, but I was really enamored with it because I just see there's so much, it's just good sense. You know, there's nothing metaphysical. It's just like a recipe for a good meal. But as I got up here, all the words I wanted to say fell away. I mean, you know, really, you talk about it and you muddy the water and your practice and what's been built here. You know, what I walked into the other day was just so powerful. You know, things just start falling away. And you need to rewrite. I'm thankful for the straightforward quality of this text, and it is like a handbook in its simplicity. But don't be deceived. The profundity of these teachings take you all the way back to the ancestors, future Buddhas, and most importantly, what's happening right now. I think, in essence, Roshi's words that the four methods are a code on how to support each other in our practice sums it all up. How do we support each other? How do you wait? How do we hustle because we don't want to make you wait? How are all of these things interwoven in our practice of realizing the great pearl? There's a thank you card on the table out there. There's a thank you for all the Dharma talks of Dai Session. And it's from Sangha member Jean Lee. She writes on behalf of herself and Jack Baiju Poji, who is her husband. And she's been taking really loving care of Jack since he fell a few years back. And she writes, I was deeply moved by your expressions of your true selves and so grateful to feel a part of this wonderful Sangha. A special thanks for those Sangha members who set up, record, and send the podcasts. I just wanted to share this glimpse because if you want to know identity action, it's here. It's a little card on the table. And it's a reminder and an acknowledgement of all those who are not in this room, but completely present nonetheless. I was also very moved by the Dharma talks from Dai Sechen. I listened to them at home and I stared at the sky. And I was wondering how you all were doing up here. It's been so cool. And I wondered if you would still hear the cicadas at night. And when the people were speaking, I was listening for the familiar birds in the background because sometimes you'll hear them tweeting. And I found that when I'm listening to the Dharma talks, it's often the personal stories that I glom onto. It's the part where, oh, all of a sudden I find time passes by and my mind is not wandered. And they can be very simple stories. Soshin crying at night alone in her bed because she thought a compliment that someone gave her was a criticism. And I thought, oh my God, I did that last year. That's just what I did. Somebody said something really nice to me. And I thought, oh, you're being sarcastic. Oh, is that what you come here for? And I got so insulted. Crazy, crazy stuff comes up, all of our mishigas. Session gives us such good material to work with. Then there was Joan's harrowing experience of being horribly beaten in an act of homophobic violence. And those who go back with him to those days just remember the raw scars on the back of his head. Yet he took us back there and recalled in stark detail the whole thing, what the tree bark looked like. And he even dared to look at, just glimpse because it wasn't safe, the humanity in his attacker's eyes. That's such wisdom. To be present to the frailty of our being is an act of giving. To realize that the qualities of strength and fragility are not fixed, but in relation to one another in our lives and that of all sentient beings is part of realizing the great pearl. And today I want to talk more about this fragility and the interpenetration of all four methods. So first, just to review what we have here, we have the individual methods. We have giving, kind speech, beneficial action, and identity action. And each of these are important. But the subtle truth of the four methods and its deeper power is that they're all present in each other at the same time. Dogen writes, each of the four methods of guidance include all four. Thus, there are 16 methods of guiding sentient beings. I don't have the patience for numbers. I don't go by quantity. And I don't think that's his point. I think his point is more that these qualities are not fixed in nature. They light on us temporarily in all different ways, but they're not fixed. And so as Kaku brought up, in order to hear, you have to listen to what's being said. There's a relationship. And here at the Village Zendo, we can see the four methods and how they penetrate. As I came up here, I was asking some of the seniors how Ango was going this year. And the one aspect that everyone mentioned was how packed to the gills we are this year. Seems to be what's special. We've never had so many people that we were sitting in the Buddha Hall. What brings so many of us here? So I was thinking about the four methods and the act of giving and causal relations. Do we have a common causal relation that brought us all here? I mean, there are many, many causal relations that brought us here. But I just wanted to take a look at one example. And that is, and one example and how it's reverberated throughout time. In the beginning, it's simple. Roshi and Sensei Joshin gave their apartment so that the Village Zendo would be housed. And those of us who were there at the time know it wasn't a large apartment. It was a smallish two-bedroom apartment, and it was enough at that time. What a brave commitment to their practice. Can you imagine people in your house every night of the week and on weekends? I mean, I would have gone absolutely nuts. But they made that offering to continue the teachings of their teachers. They were giving back what they had been given. And their offering was answered by many VZ Sangha members who came to that apartment and gave and continued to give. And before you knew it, we outgrew that apartment and another space in between before we ended up where we are now. And we continue to expand at the seams here. This giving, it's exponential. It keeps on pushing through boundaries and growing. Dogen says, the power of causal relations of giving reaches to devas, human beings, and enlightened sages. When giving becomes actual, causal relations are immediately formed. And here we are. Another example of the unfixed nature of what we've been handed down here is the whole institution or the practice of Shusa. And Bokushu, our current Shuso, is a powerful example. He cares about social injustice. He has personal integrity. He reminds us how many people in Uganda are being killed because they're gay. He keeps the doors unlocked. He tends the altars. He does it all. I'm very proud. To have him. And while he's our Shuso, we hold him up with all our heart. He's us. He's our representation. On Sunday, he gives a Dharma talk. Before you know it, someone's yelling, Hosan, and we're on to the next Shuso. We're preparing for the next Shuso. And the power is that it's unfixed. Can you imagine how we would despise a permanent Shuso? You know, it has to be unfixed. We all have to have the potential Shuso in us, or the past Shuso in us, or the future Shuso. It's unfixed. During this Ango period, I haven't been up here as much as I'd like. My mother became very ill in June and required quite a bit of nursing. She was in the hospital for over a week, and my brother was gone, so I was really alone in caring for her. And my relationship to my mother is extremely close. I was sitting in meditation before at that window, and I saw a mother deer come with two little fawns walking by. And it was just so powerful, the way the fawns, you know, she just walked a little bit further away and she paused and they scampered after her. There was this subtle communication on, you know, how far you can get, how far you're allowed to go. And that distance will continue to grow as they grow up until, poof, they're off, they're on their own. And if they're male, they're really out there because they can't be part of the herd, because they'll fight with the other male. So my relationship, what I'm trying to say here is my relationship to my mother. It's so easy to get out there. So much of who I am has been formed by my mother. And so being in relation to her fragility really put me in touch with my own fragility and my own apprehensions about aging. And a story came to mind that takes me back to the beginning of my practice, and it's when I first became aware of my fragility. And that was actually an entrance way into practice. Back in the early 90s, I was in a rundown supermarket in the village. And this is back in the days I was an AIDS activist. And I was part of a whole movement that formed to fight back against the HIV/AIDS pandemic, sexism and racism and homophobia. And that movement gave birth to a number of other movements. And it takes us to the present. We wouldn't be talking about issues like marriage equality if it wasn't for the work of the AIDS activists, or at least I feel that way. But I was at that point part of a group called the Lesbian Avengers. And we were really badass fire-eating activists. And so here I am, my badass self, a knapsack and my Swiss Army knife. I was ready for anything, revolution, exile, anything that came up, I was ready. And all of a sudden I heard this awful thud, and I turned around and there was this elderly woman who was on the floor, and I went over to help her, and when I knelt down, I was pretty taken back because her injuries were pretty bad. Her nose was broken, had been broken in the fall, and there was blood coming out of her nose, and you could see the white of her shin bone sticking through her calf, and she was hurt. But she was remarkably composed. I mean, she wasn't screaming. She knew she was hurt. And, she said, call an ambulance, and an ambulance was called. And so I sat down next to her. And I just remember how much I wanted to comfort her and how much I wanted to say, you know, don't worry, help is on the way. You'll be okay, and all the things you say. But I just started to cry. I couldn't stop crying. And I couldn't say anything because every time I wanted to say something, it would just be like, you know, I would blubber. And I just felt so uncomposed and so unequipped for what was going on, what was happening to this elegant woman who is composed, waiting for help. So I just sat next to her, and we waited for the ambulance to come. And I just held her hand. And the thing is, when the EMT guys finally arrived, and just be just before they were putting her on the stretcher, she looked at me and she said, and she saw that, like, I could almost not make eye contact because I was afraid I was going to cry. And she said, "You care for me." We say, you know, Buddha recognizes Buddha, but who is the Buddha in this situation? It wasn't fixed. It was everyone who responded to this woman's call. A woman falls. What do you do? What's right speech? Sometimes it's saying nothing. It's a gesture. It's what you can give in that particular moment. Dogen says, action means you cause yourself to be in identity with others after causing others to be in identity with you. However, the relationship of self and others varies limitlessly according to circumstances. It's always going to surprise you. You say that I'm giving a talk, but anyone who's ever got up in front of a classroom knows that there's nothing given unless attention is offered. There's always an interrelationship between what's given, what's offered. Can we give ourselves to what's being offered here? Session is almost over. By Sunday afternoon, you won't recognize this room. It'll be gone in a woof. How are you going to spend the remaining hours here? It's not time to hold back. It's time to really go where you need to go. And I'm going to leave you with one last story. And this one happened last week. I was waiting for my niece on the corner of 6th Avenue and 42nd Street right near Bryant Park. It's one of the most busy corners in Manhattan. And again, I heard a thud. And I looked over, and there was this woman on her hands and knees. And right away, you know, I'm like, oh. And I went over to her with my arms out to help her. And she looked up at me with this big smile. And she said, "Please don't help me." So I backed away. And I just gave her space. And I was just, you know, kind of trying to block, you know, people from walking into her. And over the course of the next few minutes, I watched this incredible feat of physical composure. It was as if she was trying to stand on legs that had fallen asleep. And, you know, we've seen this in the Zendo when somebody tries to get up and their legs are not there. And she sort of got herself into a squatting position next to a building. And what she was trying to do was sort of plunge herself upright, like diagonally, so she would hit the building and then be able to sort of balance herself straight. And she tries a couple of times to do this. And finally, she got upright. And by that time, my niece had joined me, and she was looking at me like, "Why aren't you helping?" And I just, like I'm the sadist. And so I just pulled her over to me. And the woman came over to me and my niece Cosette. And she said, "Thank you. I have MS. And I really have no business walking out here in such a busy area without a walker. But I just don't want to go there yet." And multiple sclerosis is this disease that disrupts the communication between your mind and your body. And it often progresses. But she wasn't going there yet. She was radiant as she walked up 6th Avenue. And you want to talk about giving. What she gave me was incredible. To witness that supreme commitment to be present to physical challenge and pain and uncertainty. I hope I can spend the last few days of session with her effort and my own and yours and all sentient beings in mind. Meeting the moment without turning away, getting lost in your pain, fatigue, or euphoria. Can we give what's needed, take what's offered, and support each other completely in our practice of one great pearl? Don't let the fading summer pass you by.